From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
And when you look at the background of Cheney and the others, they personally will make tens of millions of pounds as they carve up the concessions to Iraqi oil if they invade and put in their puppet regime.
Hundreds of thousands of people are marching against war from Britain to Denver to Rome. Today we'll hear from the protests in London this weekend with British MP George Galloway, filmmaker John Pilger, UN weapons inspector Scott Ritter, and others. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Saddam Hussein appears poised last night to agree to resume UN arms inspections in Iraq, but now the United States is calling to put the inspections on hold. Secretary of State General Colin Powell said last night UN weapons inspectors should delay any mission to Iraq until the UN Security Council finishes deliberations on a possible new resolution that would tighten up the inspection regime. In Vienna, senior Iraqi officials for the first time discussed details of an inspection regime abandoned almost 4 years ago and pledged to supply 4 years of detailed reports on Iraq's dual-use technology, which could be deployed for military purposes. The talks in Vienna are seen as crucial for Baghdad to avoid war. The United States is pressing for a hardline UN resolution mandating rapid and unlimited inspections and threatening military action if Iraq fails to comply. UN officials were optimistic about returning to Baghdad to enjoy unfettered access, but U.S. War Secretary Donald Rumsfeld described the Iraqi pledges on inspections as patently false. Two Senate Republicans called on President Bush yesterday to build an international coalition before striking Iraq. This sets the stage for a lively and divisive debate this week over the administration's strategy to enforce weapons inspections and topple Saddam Hussein. Republican Senators Chuck Hagel of Nebraska, Richard Lugar of Indiana, lobbied Bush to agree explicitly to work more closely with U.S. allies to eliminate Hussein's nuclear, chemical, and biological capabilities. Hagel encouraged the president to exhaust his diplomatic efforts at the United Nations before confronting Iraq. The White House objected to the Hagel-Lugar proposal, but says there may be a compromise as early as today. The Senate's expected to begin debating the Iraq War resolution tomorrow and hold a final vote next week. The House is working on a similar timetable, which would carry the debate within 4 weeks of the November 5th midterm elections. Check out Democracy Now!'s website to get the latest information on the number of calls that are coming in to both Republican and Democratic Senate offices, in some cases running 100, 500, 1,000 to 1 against war. And speaking of the midterm elections, Democratic Senator Robert Torricelli of New Jersey has announced he's ending his bid for re-election, acknowledging his campaign has become overwhelmed by questions about improper gifts he accepted from a contributor. After serving in the House of Representatives, he became a senator in 96. He served as chair of the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee, where he raised $100 million for Democrats. Torricelli's fundraising conduct led to a rebuke by the Senate Ethics Committee in July. The issue also dominated the current campaign, leading Democratic Party leaders in Washington to warn in recent weeks that his election is in danger and that his defeat might cost them control of the Senate. Torricelli's abrupt departure through the gubernatorial race into the Senate race into chaos in New Jersey. The election is 36 days away. Republicans have promised a legal challenge to prevent Torricelli's name from being replaced on the ballot. Democratic leaders are still debating over possible candidates to replace him, including former Senator Bill Bradley. Atomic energy officials said Monday a substance seized by police near the Syrian border is not weapons-grade uranium, as Turkish officials first reported, this according to the Anatolia News Agency. The head of the Atomic Energy Institute said the material's harmless, containing zinc, iron, zirconium, manganese. The announcement ended days of speculation that the substance might have been destined for neighboring Iraq, which the United States accuses of trying to smuggle in nuclear material for a secret weapons program. Late Monday, the Israeli army cracked down on Palestinians, defying a curfew in the West Bank city of Nablus. It killed two Palestinian children. An Israeli soldier also died. 10 more Palestinians were injured, including an 11-year-old. And in Gaza, a Palestinian man working as a watchman on a farm was hit by Israeli bullets as two tanks and a bulldozer rolled into Gaza City. Meanwhile, in Ramallah, the Israeli army has quietly redeployed around Yasser Arafat's office, keeping the Palestinian leader in close check. Amnesty International is reporting that children are increasingly bearing the brunt of continued conflict between the Israeli and Palestinian communities. The more than 250 Palestinian children have died in the current intifada, with the average age of victims falling, Amnesty claimed, adding more than 70 Israeli children have died, mostly through suicide bombings. The human rights group accused the army of failing to punish Israeli soldiers who use unlawful and excessive use of lethal force against stone-throwing children, also blamed Palestinian leaders for failing to rein in the bombers. United States Immigration Naturalization Service is starting to register people from selected Arab and Muslim countries on arrival into the country. Under the new policy, immigration staff will routinely fingerprint, photograph, and question potential entrants, checking their pictures and prints against criminal and terrorist databases. The U.S. Justice Department has also issued a directive that anyone who has frequently visited the Middle East, North Africa, Cuba, or North Korea can be taken aside as well if they don't have what it calls a credible explanation for their trip. All citizens of Iran, Iraq, Libya, Syria, and Sudan will be targeted, and visitors, especially men from other Muslim and Middle Eastern countries, may also be subject to the new measures. The measures introduced nationwide today could potentially apply to any of the 35 million foreign visitors who come to the United States every year. The South African trade union movement has begun a two-day strike against government privatization policy. BBC's reporting that the strike is the latest open example of conflict over policy between the government of President Thabo Mbeki and some of his closest supporters. And police used unconstitutional tactics and abused their authority when they arrested hundreds during the weekend anti-corporate globalization protests in Washington, D.C. This, according to the arrested activists and their attorneys. Police arrested more than 650 people on just the first day of the protests on Friday, coinciding with the annual meetings of the World Bank and the IMF. Outraged lawyers yesterday said police tricked or bullied many of those arrested into paying a fine and not challenging the charges in court. Police Chief Charles Ramsey gave his officers an A-plus grade for their weekend performance. You are listening to Democracy Now!'s War and Peace Report, another show of resistance. I'm Amy Goodman. In the last few weeks, anti-war sentiment has been growing around the country. Last Thursday in Portland, Maine, a demonstration against the war in Iraq was met with 14 arrests and police violence. Protesters took to the streets during presidential visits in Flagstaff, Phoenix, Houston, and Trenton, New Jersey. Over 3,000 people in Denver protested Bush's visit on Friday, and the same same day he was met with protests in Houston, Texas. Across the globe, anti-war resistance is gaining momentum. Last week in Rome, 100,000 people protested the war in Iraq. Another massive demonstration is planned for November 8th in Florence. And in Cairo, tens of thousands took to the streets to protest U.S. militarism. Similar rallies took place in Berlin, Madrid, Dublin, Sydney, and New Zealand. We're now going to move to what was called the largest peace demonstration in Britain since the Vietnam War. Independent Media Center is putting the numbers at close to 500,000 people who demonstrated against war in Iraq in London Saturday. The march was marked with banners, puppets, music, and noise brigades. Protesters burned effigies of Bush, Blair, and the Italian Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi. Among the many people who spoke were Scott Ritter, the former UN weapons inspector, the mayor of London, Ken Livingstone, as well as filmmaker John Pilger. We're going to start, though, with British MP, Member of Parliament George Galloway, who recently returned from Iraq and met with Saddam Hussein. This is George Galloway.
Bush's administration, which is corruptly elected, Bush is only president because his governor brother in Florida had half the black voters stripped off the voting rolls. Otherwise, there wouldn't be Bush's corrupt crew in the White House. And his administration, which is up to its neck in Enron, wants the diversion as much as it wants the oil. And when you look at the backgrounds of Cheney and the others, they personally will make tens of millions of pounds as they carve up the concessions to Iraqi oil if they invade and put in their puppet regime. This, as 10 years ago, is a war for oil. It is not a war about human rights. It's certainly not a war about weapons of mass destruction, because there is only one regime in the Middle East that has nuclear weapons, and it's not Saddam Hussein, it is Israel, who have had nuclear weapons for 30 years, and there is no action being planned to take those nuclear weapons away from Sharon. So it is once again what it has been for the last decade or more: hypocrisy and double standards, as America retains its neo-colonial hold on the oil-producing regions of the world. And it is a disgrace that once again Britain is running along like a little lapdog behind America's imperial interests. When people voted for this government, they wanted a government that would represent their interests, not be simply an echo of the White House. How can you send British troops to die in a war in Iraq when they know the vast majority of the British people are opposed to that war? The British people don't back you, Tony Blair. They want you to be a voice for peace. There's been enough casual death of Arabs. Stand up to America. Listen to the people here today and the people that voted for you before. Make sure you say no to war.
British Minister of Parliament George Galloway speaking at the rally on Saturday. Now to Salma Yaqub, chair of the Birmingham Stop the War Coalition.
It's no accident that while the world has been remembering and mourning the attacks of September the 11th this month, Bush and Blair have launched their war drive against Iraq. Indeed, this pair has been busy cashing in on that tragedy for a whole year now. This time last year, they were preparing to bomb Afghanistan. We said then that justice, not vengeance, should be the response. Killing more innocent people was not the answer. A year on, I stand here, and we are at the eve of yet another terrible war, this time against Iraq. In Afghanistan, they destroyed an already devastated country. In Iraq, They've been destroying a developed country systematically over the last 12 years through the vicious sanctions. And now they want to cause further misery and bloodshed to the people of Iraq by bombing them. Through their tactics of promoting the villain of the moment, last year Osama bin Laden and now Saddam Hussein, our leadership has deliberately clouded and fudged the real underlying issues, such as the scramble for oil. It's no mere accident that Iraq has got the second largest oil resource in the world. I think it's time that the thief of Washington and his mates learn to buy their commodities just like everyone else. At this critical and depressing time, we, the ordinary citizens, have a profound responsibility to act. Many of our politicians, who should be our true representatives, have responded shamefully with silence on important issues for too long, on the issues of Palestine, Kashmir, Chechnya. Our arrogant leadership seeks to spread confusion among the people. And right now, we need to hold on to and provide the clarity that is required in this situation. That's why this demonstration is so important. We have all come out today to say no more. We don't want this war. The hour is late and we have a huge challenge. There are real lives and futures at stake, both abroad and here. What is needed is a determined, conscious mass resistance like today. I support the call of Tony Benn that we should all stop working, even for a few minutes, to show our opposition to the war. A temporary disruption in this country can help to remove a permanent disruption of another country. The good news is that people are waking up. Never before have we had a position where an anti-war movement was this strong even before a war was started. Tony Blair, in his offensive drive, has now been put on the defensive. For whilst he was busy talking to Bush and his mates, the people of this country have been talking to each other and we have made our stance clear. On a personal note, I want to say how inspiring it is to be here. I cannot deny that post-September 11th, there has been a backlash against Muslims. Many of us have felt demonized and isolated. Yet here we are together, side by side, all of us united in our demand for peace and justice. Finally, Blair's simplistic propaganda, as exemplified by his dossier this week, would be laughable if the consequences weren't so serious. The spinning and lies remind me of the story of the Emperor's new clothes. What Blair doesn't realise, though, is that the people of this country actually aren't stupid and we have cottoned on to his lies. My message to Tony Blair is, you've been exposed now and we don't like what we see. Thanks.
Salma Yaqub, chair of Birmingham Stop the War Coalition, speaking in London this weekend. And now to Ken Livingstone, the mayor of London.
I'm looking out upon this ocean of people. At the back of this crowd can simply not be seen. People are still marching in Piccadilly, 5.5 hours after the front left the demonstration point. And I tell you this, when Tony Blair switches on his television set in his 5-star hotel room in Blackpool this evening, his face will turn several shades of green. Now today, Today is the second anniversary of the Palestinian uprising, the Al-Aqsa Intifada. But we're asked to believe that we must plunge the Middle East into devastating war in the name of UN Security Council resolutions. Well, I say this, whatever the decisions of the United Nations Security Council, and I ask the great countries of France, Russia, and China, don't humiliate yourselves in the way that our country is being humiliated. Stand up to George Bush. But whatever the decision of the Security Council, millions of people in Britain and tens of millions around the world will oppose this war for oil. Because that's what this war is about. Hundreds of years of supply of oil lies in the Arabian Gulf. Only two countries in the Arabian Gulf are not the puppets of Britain and America. One of them is Iraq, and one of them is Iran. And if we allow the attack on Iraq, Iran will quickly follow so that they can control the oil reserves of the world as part of their imperialist domination.
London Mayor Ken Livingstone at the massive rally for peace in London. More than 400,000 people gathered on Saturday. When we come back, we'll hear from Scott Ritter, the former UN weapons inspector, and filmmaker John Pilger. If you'd like to order a video or audio cassette copy of today's program, you can call 1-800-881-2359. That's 1-800-881-2359. Back in a minute.
Did you see them praying? Watch the army marching in. As they clubbed old women, did you see the general grin? Watch the stones fly and the snipers taking aim. On Shatila's birthday, it's a calculated game. And they're gunning down the children of Jerusalem. Did you hear him screaming? Watch the horror on his face as he hid for cover in a tiny unprotected space. Did you hear his father pleading? There is a child here trying to protect his son, who yelled in horror and in fear that they're gunning down the children of Jerusalem.
Children of Jerusalem, David Rovics here on Democracy Now! David was in Washington at the peace protests this weekend. As we go to London, to the massive rally of more than 400,000 people this past Saturday. Among those who spoke was John Pilger. He just released the film Palestine is Still the Issue, and before that, Paying the Price, Killing the Children of Iraq. This is filmmaker John Pilger.
It gives me the greatest pleasure to introduce to you someone whom I'm sure all of you have been waiting to listen to today. All of us, a few days ago, watched the compelling documentary, Palestine is Still the Issue. And it gives me great pleasure to introduce to you Mr. John Pilger.
I was just asked by somebody from the BBC, didn't I think that the people of this country were really suffering from compassion fatigue? And I said, this is your answer, 350 to 400,000 people suffering from compassion fatigue like hell. It's a great privilege to be here. I think that today may well be the beginning of true democracy in the new century. You know, democracy is not a game played in an institution that rubber stamps a government. Democracy is not one obsessed man using the power of kings to attack another country in our name.
Democracy is not siding with Ariel Sharon, a war criminal, in order to crush the Palestinians. Democracy is this great event today representing the majority of the people of Great Britain. Now, I've been to Iraq, and I've been recently to Palestine, and I've seen the suffering in those countries. The children dying in cancer wards in southern Iraq, dying because their country is denied the equipment to fight their cancer and to clean up battlefields contaminated by depleted uranium, a weapon of mass destruction used by the United States and Britain 12 years ago. Let me quote two American scholars, John and Carl Muller, who have examined objectively all the statistics of suffering in Iraq since the embargo was imposed 12 years ago. They conclude, and I quote, "Economic sanctions have probably already taken the lives of more people in Iraq than have been killed by all weapons of mass destruction in history." That research appeared not in a campaign pamphlet, but in the American establishment journal, Foreign Affairs. It's a truth that many of my fellow journalists and broadcasters ignore or whisper because they know what it means. It means that a great crime against Iraq has already been committed in our name. And if they are honest with themselves, they will know that the flattery of these imperial politicians has to stop and the truth has to be told. Half the population of Iraq are children. Consider what will happen to them when the cluster bombs fall and the depleted uranium is used as it will be. You know, we speak only of murder when some tragic and hideous event happens in familiar circumstances. But there is no difference, let me assure you, between murder committed here and murder committed by our government and its allies in Iraq and in Palestine. This is not rhetoric, and it's time our public language was freed of its double standards. If they attack Iraq, Bush and Blair will be international criminals. They must be stopped because other countries will be next. Iran, North Korea, perhaps even eventually China. What is so exciting about today and all the other demonstrations and meetings that are happening all over Britain is that they represent the true moral mainstream of political life in this country. Today, a taboo has been broken. We are the moderates. Bush and Blair are the extremists. The danger for all of us lies not in Baghdad. The danger lies not in Baghdad, but in Washington. Only one country has used a nuclear weapon of mass destruction against civilians. Only one country has threatened to use nuclear weapons in Southeast Asia and the Middle East. Only one country has torn up all the treaties that were forged over years to prevent this happening. Only one country is developing nuclear weapons for what they call preemptive use, and that is the United States. Tony Blair belongs to George W. Bush, not to us. If he joins the attack on Iraq, he will kill untold numbers of innocent people, and he will promote the kind of terrorism that endangers the lives of all of us. Is that what they call patriotism? Blair and Bush are the true enemy within. I believe we have no choice now. Our resistance to their murderous plans must be unrelenting. Thank you.
Filmmaker John Pilger. Scott Ritter also spoke at the massive British protest against war, the former UN weapons inspector.
I commend you for being here today. We are on the verge of engaging in a military action against Iraq. And the President of the United States has war plans on his desk that speak of sending 100,000 or 200,000 American troops off to fight, kill and be killed in Iraq. And yet here today, we have a crowd four times that size, an army of peace, democracy's divisions, waging peace, rejecting war. Thank you for being here. Now, people have asked me, why am I here today? And the answer is simple. I am an American. I stand for what America stands for. America is a nation of laws, laws that are set forth in the Constitution, which founded my great country, and I reject the policies that George W. Bush is pursuing wholeheartedly. Now, what purpose do I see by being here today? I would like to send two messages. The first message is to Prime Minister Tony Blair in response to his dossier regarding Iraq's weapons of mass destruction. Mr. Blair, I too share your concern about Iraq's weapons of mass destruction because I know more than you what Iraq had and what had been accomplished in the field of disarmament. I know that while we did not account for everything in regards to Iraq's weapons, and there are still things to be done in the field of disarmament, that weapons inspections do work, can work, and will work if allowed to go back into Iraq unfettered by manipulation of the United States and Great Britain. I do know that there is a job to be done. I am not giving Iraq a clean bill of health. They have not yet earned it. They must do so, and they say that they will hold themselves fully accountable to the rule of law as set forth by the Security Council, and I, for one, am in favor of making Saddam keep his promise. But we, too, have a promise we must keep. A promise of running a clean investigation free of the corruption of American influence that seeks to remove Saddam Hussein, not disarm Saddam Hussein. So, Mr. Blair, while I commend you for publishing this document and reinforcing the concerns that I and many others have about unresolved issues, I say this to you. This document is not a case for war. This document does not make the case for war. This document is not worth one drop of blood from an American soldier, a British soldier, or an Iraqi civilian. That is my message to Prime Minister Tony Blair and his government. Now I have a second message I would like to send to President George W. Bush. But first of all, I need to say something. For those of you out there who are leading the chants of down, down, USA, shame on you. Shame on you. This is an argument between you and the administration of George W. Bush, not between you and the American people. The American people are a law-abiding people. The American people are a good people. And the American people can be your ally if you let them. The first thing that has to occur is that you have to motivate the people of America, and you are doing so today with this demonstration of democracy. You need to empower the people of America to confront the policies of George W. Bush, because the policies of George W. Bush are inherently un-American. We have a saying in the United States. It's a saying that friends don't let friends drive drunk. Ladies and gentlemen, we have an alcoholic at the wheel of American foreign policy named George W. Bush. And we, the people of the United States of America, need your assistance to reach in, grab the keys from the ignition, and say, no, we will not allow you to drive the vehicle of international peace and security over the cliff of war. Thank you very much for being here today. Thank you.
Former UN Weapons Inspector Scott Ritter addressing crowds of hundreds of thousands in Britain this past Saturday. And you are listening to Democracy Now!'s War and Peace Report. If you want to get copies of the program, you can call 1-800-881-2359. That's 1-800-881-2359. As President-elect Bush wages his war abroad, he is also cracking down at home. He has threatened to send in troops if dock workers strike. Meanwhile, port operators from Seattle to San Diego have shut down close to 30 West Coast ports in a dispute with the Longshoremen's Union. More than 10,000 members of the International Longshore and Warehouse Union were left without jobs late Sunday when the Pacific Maritime Association accused the union of engaging in a deliberate slowdown, which it claims has paralyzed West Coast shipping. Operations at bustling seaports such as Seattle, Washington, Long Beach, Oakland, California came to a halt Sunday until an agreement is reached on the key issue, union's role in the increasing use of technology. On the line with us now is Jack Heyman. He is on the picket line in Oakland. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Jack.
How's it going?
It's good. Can
I'm
you describe
on the radio right now? I'm on the radio.
Can you describe what's happening? Jack, can you describe what's happening?
I'm sorry. Yeah, well, it's pretty hectic right now on the picket line here in Oakland. We're dispatching our members to the different terminals, and so far we've been met with very solid support from the different AFL-CIO unions. We just have a little glitch in the oil or flying the oil with the machinists, but most of them are honoring the picket line at this time.
Can you talk about the lockout?
Well, the employers locked us out last Friday because our members were working by the safety code. And I think you realize this is one of the high-hazard industries, and we've been working by the safety code. The employers called it a slowdown, and they locked us out on Friday. They changed their position and rehired us Sunday and locked us out again. On the second lockout on Sunday, we set up picket lines. All AFL-CIO unions are honoring the picket line, and we feel that with that kind of support, that kind of solidarity, is going to force the PMA to negotiate in good faith.
Can you talk about what's at issue?
Well, the main stumbling block is technology, and the union's position is that we're willing to discuss technology. We want the new jobs that are going to come with the technology, and that's what the employers are resistant to. The one day they say we can get the new jobs that are created from technology. The next day they take it back. So there really hasn't been honest negotiations coming from the employers.
When you talk about working to safety code, can you explain what you mean?
Well, we don't go up into the container bays when the cranes are working. Sometimes there are stacking cones that fall off, they hit people, lashing rods fall, there are speed limits in the yard. We've had 5 deaths this year alone and many, many injuries, about 1 for every 2 longshore workers here. So we're working by the safety code to ensure that there aren't any more accidents and injuries.
And can you just describe your surroundings right now at the Oakland port for listeners and viewers around the country?
All of the terminals here have been picketed. There are, I think, 7 ships that are docked in the port. Most of them have their hatch covers or lids off on the dock so they can't sail. There was an attempt earlier at a couple of the terminals to load those lids with other than ILWU labor. We were successful in stopping that. And so for the time being, those ships are trapped in port. The same conditions exist in the other major ports on the West Coast, Seattle, Tacoma, Portland, and Los Angeles, Long Beach.
We have to break for stations to identify themselves, and we'll be back with Jack Heyman of the International Longshore and Warehouse Union. They've been locked out on coasts, in ports along the West Coast. We'll also be joined by labor journalist David Bacon.
After that, we're going to go down to Venezuela,
talk about the threatened strike there. Stay with us.
Union brothers and union sisters,
we've got to keep the union strong.
Union brothers and union sisters,
we've got to keep the union strong.
This old union, it keeps on growing.
We've got to keep the union strong.
This old union keeps on growing.
We've got to keep the union strong.
Union brothers and union sisters,
we've got to keep the union strong.
Union brothers and union sisters,
we've got to keep the union strong.
Fighting for our workers,
we got to keep the union strong.
We keep fighting for our workers,
we got to keep the union strong.
Union brothers and union sisters.
Union brothers and sisters, New York City Labor Chorus here on Democracy Now! Breaking the Sound Barrier. I'm Amy Goodman, joined by Jack Heyman on the picket line at the Oakland port. Again, port operators have shut down more than 30 ports along the West Coast, locking out the longshore workers. And they are at every port right now holding picket signs that say lockout, ILWU lockout by PMA, Pacific Maritime Association. David Bacon also on the line with us. Can you talk, David Bacon, about the significance of this protest?
Well, I think that unions all over the U.S. are watching what's going on here, partly because of the threats that have been made in the past by the Bush administration to intervene. Even before negotiations started, the Pacific Maritime Association and some of the big customers of shipping, familiar names like The Gap, Mattel, and Home Depot, joined together in a waterfront coalition which began holding meetings with a White House task force headed by White House advisor Carlos Bonilla. And when negotiations started, Homeland Secretary Tom Ridge and representatives of the Department of Labor called the president of the ILWU, James Spinoza, and told him that the White House would act if the union were to go on strike or engage in job action. And among the things that they mentioned were the possibility of bringing troops in to run the container cranes, invoking the Taft-Hartley Act, which would impose an 80-day cooling-off period or back-to-work order on the union, possibly bringing the union under the Railway Labor Act, which would remove its right to strike, or breaking up its coast-wide agreement, which allows the union to negotiate for all the workers who work in all the ports on the West Coast at the same time. So the threat of that kind of federal intervention is obviously something that concerns unions elsewhere, because if Bush could do it here, he could do it in other places. And Bush has been willing to invoke back-to-work orders on airline workers, for instance, both at Northwest Airlines and at others in the past, too. So it wouldn't be surprising to see the Bush administration take the side of the employers in this case and force the union to work. And, in fact, I think that the threat of invoking Taft-Hartley and an 80-day back-to-work order is still a very real one, because were the Bush administration to do that, it would essentially make it very, very difficult for the union to do the kinds of things that Jack has been describing, as far as making sure that the work pace on the waterfront is one that's safe and doesn't cost workers their lives, as the five workers who died earlier this year because of accidents on the waterfront.
Jack Heyman, final comments, if you're still with us on the picket line in Oakland.
I am. Unfortunately, I couldn't hear a word that David said. I'm on my cell phone here.
How long do you expect this to be happening? And do you expect George Bush to send in the troops, what some are calling the troops for trade?
We expect some kind of federal intervention, whether it's troops or Taft-Hartley or a federal mediator. The federal government is one way or another going to stick its nose into this. They're blaming the longshoremen for the state of the economy, and obviously that's not true. In a capitalist society, workers don't run it, and there's plenty of problems on Wall Street that we can point fingers at. We think that victory will come because our picket lines are solid up and down the West Coast. We have tremendous support overseas from the dock workers' unions, so that even if they send the troops in to load the ships, they're not going to be offloaded in any port in the world. And we think that's going to bring PMA to the negotiating table and force them to negotiate in good faith.
David Bacon.
I'm sorry, Amy, what are you asking?
In terms of this struggle located in the larger labor movement right now, and in terms of the so-called war on terror, not only abroad but at home, how the Bush administration is dealing with this and how it bodes for the rest of the labor movement in this country?
Well, it's a big threat, Amy, because of the rationale that the Bush administration is using here. The Bush administration is saying that the movement of cargo across the docks, which is essentially an economic question, is a matter of national security. In fact, the Bush administration is interpreting any threat to employers at this point as being a threat to national security, and that provides a pretext for doing things which would be pretty extreme, whether invoking Taft-Hartley or militarizing the docks or ordering workers back to work at airlines, or, for instance, creating an entire department of the federal government, the Homeland Security Department, without any unions. So what's happening here on the waterfront has very big implications for the status of workers and the continuing use of the national security rationale to essentially justify union busting.
Well, I want to thank you both for being with us. David Bacon, labor journalist. Where can people read your reports, David?
Well, there's a recent article in the coming up issue of The American Prospect about national security, and they can also get them online at www.igc.org/dbacon/.
And Jack Heyman, on the front lines at the port in Oakland, how can people read more about the struggle of the ILWU?
We have two excellent websites that people can go to. That's www.ilwu.org. That's our official website. And then there's one out of Liverpool, England, which has excellent coverage. That's www.labornet.net. That's labor with a U, the English spelling, obviously. That's the best way to keep posted on what's going on the waterfront.
Well, thanks for being with us both. We move south now to Venezuela. On Monday, opposition labor and business leaders in Venezuela announced they'll soon organize another general strike against the government of President Hugo Chavez. The last strike resulted in the April attempted coup that left dozens dead and earned the repudiation of governments worldwide, except for the U.S. government, which at first supported the coup, not to mention the New York Times editorial pages that seemed to endorse the coup when it first happened, but it was fought back and Chavez remains in power. Chavez has trumped his opponents by signing a 2-year contract with oil workers. The September 16th contract gave workers a 35% pay raise and a deal that persuaded Fedepetrol, the largest oil union, to abandon strike plans. Venezuela is one of the United States' biggest oil suppliers. Oil accounts for a third of Venezuela's $100 billion gross domestic product and almost half of government income. We're joined today in our studio by two women talking about what's happening in Venezuela. We are joined by Noelie Pacatera, who is a member of the Executive Committee of the World Council of Indigenous Peoples, and she is the first Indigenous woman vice president of the Venezuelan National Assembly. Welcome to Democracy Now! It's great to have you with us. We are also joined by Blanca Ecut, who is director of Katia TVE, a community TV station in Caracas and a spokesperson for Venezuela's alternative media. Can you start off, Blanca Ecut, by talking about the role the media played in the attempted coup against Chavez, specifically the Cisneros, who is a close ally, particularly of Bush Sr., runs the largest corporate media house there.
Puedes comenzar hablando sobre el papel que jugaron los medios de comunicación en el intento de golpe contra Chávez, sobre todo el papel de Cisneros, que es uno de los líderes de los medios corporativos.
El papel fue fundamental, es decir, ellos de alguna manera armaron todo el discurso conspirativo.
They basically built up the conspiracy.
Convocaron, se convirtieron en el partido para armar el golpe.
They became the party that created the coup.
Y por eso nos enfrentamos antes del golpe con un paro virtual. Era un paro de los medios de comunicación porque aunque la gente fue a la calle.
And we basically encountered ourselves with a virtual coup
because it was real.
Because even though people went to the streets to work,
los medios permanentemente decían que el país se había parado.
The media permanently stated that the country has
Sin embargo,
come to a halt.
Eso no era cierto. Y la
but in reality,
sabía,
that was not true, and people knew it.
Convocando y creando la situación
but the
de
media
crisis.
Was constantly convocating the crisis.
La televisión en Venezuela es una de las peores. Es una televisión muy alienante.
Television in Venezuela is one of the worst. It's very alienating.
Y las dos grandes televisoras, una de esas,
Venevisión, Cisneros, channels,
que es dueño de Venevisión,
Cisneros
red,
is the owner and the owner of DirecTV has a network of Trust National and Communications.
Bueno, han determinado siempre la vida política del país.
They have always determined the political life of the country.
Hasta este momento, que desde el 98 la gente ya
until this
ha
time that since 1988 people have lost the credibility on the media.
Pero definitivamente fue determinante y es determinante en este
but
momento.
But it was definitely a determining role and it still is a determining role.
Para armar todo el paro, el golpe y todo esto y
strike,
todo el clima a coup, a nivel también internacional.
And the whole international atmosphere of what is going on in Venezuela.
El papel de los medios.
The role of the media.
Noelie Pacatera, you are vice president of the Venezuela National Assembly, a leading indigenous rights activists in your country. Can you talk about the role of the National Assembly in this time of attempted coups and particularly the role of indigenous people?
Usted vicepresidente de la Asamblea Nacional representando a las comunidades indígenas, ¿puedes hablarnos de el papel en este momento de la Asamblea Nacional y de las comunidades indígenas en este intento de golpe?
Sí, cómo no. La Asamblea Nacional está muy activa.
The Assembly, National Assembly is very active.
Aprobando las leyes que tiene que aprobar.
Passing the laws that it needs to pass.
En este último periodo hemos aprobado
in this last period we have
unas cuantas
passed
leyes,
some laws.
Y pronto vamos a aprobar otras leyes que son necesarias
and we're soon
para
to
el país.
Pass other laws that are necessary for the country.
En el caso de los
for example,
pueblos indígenas,
for the indigenous peoples,
la ley de demarcación y garantía del hábitat y tierra de los pueblos indígenas,
the law of demarcation and protection of the habitat for indigenous peoples,
la ley aprobatoria del convenio 169 de la Organización Internacional del Trabajo,
the approval of the act 169 of the International Labor Organization.
Sí, O sea que son leyes que en este momento se están aprobando que tienen que ver con los pueblos indígenas.
These are laws that at this time are being approved that have to be that are related to the indigenous peoples.
Hemos encontrado un espacio bien importante en este proceso venezolano.
We have encountered a very important space in this
en defensa de los derechos
Venezuelan process for the indigenous people in defense of the rights of the indigenous peoples. That had never happened before in Venezuela.
Consideraba ciudadanos de cuarta categoría.
We were considered fourth class citizens in Venezuela.
Hoy en día los indígenas estamos participando activamente.
Today the indigenous communities are participating in the atmosphere in Venezuela. We're living in a participating democracy.
Como las mujeres, los obreros,
as are the women, the workers, the peasants, the children, the young, the people with disabilities. Everybody is taking part in the Venezuelan process.
Do you see another coup taking, attempted coup taking place in Venezuela?
¿Usted prevé otro intento de golpe en Venezuela?
Sí, hay una amenaza de golpe de Estado.
Yes, there's a threat of another coup.
Eso está allí, pero
it's there.
Yo estoy optimista y todos en Venezuela, el pueblo, no lo van a lograr. Eso no es posible.
They're not gonna allow,
porque hay un pueblo dispuesto a defender
su proyecto. They're not going to allow it because there's a people willing to defend their project,
la democracia,
willing to defend democracy,
the participative democracy. Ellos están haciendo todos los intentos de para demostrar que no hay gobernabilidad en el país, están haciendo actos de terrorismo, hay infiltrados en sus marchas, pero eso no va a ser posible porque hay un pueblo dispuesto a defenderlo.
But that's not going to succeed because there's a people ready to defend their process.
How is the campaign of Lula in Brazil, the Brazil Workers Party? The election will be Sunday, and it looks like he could win, though the U.S. finance community is certainly against it. How is that affecting grassroots communities in Venezuela?
Las elecciones en Brasil, las elecciones en Brasil donde posiblemente gane Lula, candidato a los partidos de los trabajadores, ¿cómo está afectando eso al clima en Venezuela?
Extrañamente están haciendo una asociación entre Brasil y Venezuela.
Strangely, they're doing an association between Brazil and Venezuela.
Porque parece una amenaza que decidamos ser pueblos soberanos, es decir,
because it seems
as
a threat that we decide to be sovereign nations.
Pero hay, no entiendo muy bien cuál es la relación que se establece, pero definitivamente la gente que está propiciando una situación de golpe,
but the people that are promoting a coup,
quiere hacer el golpe antes de que gane Lula.
They want to create the coup before Lula wins.
Para poder decir no es posible un país con una política soberana propia.
To say that it's not possible to have a country with a sovereign politic.
No es posible porque si no entonces hay guerra. Hay
it's not possible because otherwise there will be a war, there will be a crisis, there will be a coup.
Yo creo que hay que decir, para nosotros es toda esta amenaza de el paro, aunque parezca contradictorio, para sacar del poder a Jacobo Arbenz en Guatemala, se hizo huelga, se generó toda una situación caótica que permitió echar por tierra una reforma agraria extraordinaria. Para dar el golpe a Allende, también se hicieron paros financiados por fuera, sindicatos corruptos, para dar el golpe
financed
a
Allende.
Y esta vez quieren hacerlo. El problema es que el pueblo venezolano no apoya los paros.
The problem is that the Venezuelan people are not supporting the strikes.
Well, on that note, I want to thank you for being with us. Blanca Ecut, director of Katia TVE, Community TV in Venezuela, and Noeli Pocatera, the vice president of the Venezuelan National Assembly. That does it for the program. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams, Mike Burke, Angie Karen. We have been engineered by, with a music maestro, Mike DeFilippo. Our website is democracynow.org. You can get a copy of today's program by calling 1-800-881-2359. 1-800-881-2359. Again, if anyone has any information about the Democracy Now! Computer that was stolen at the peace rally at DuPont Circle in Washington, please let us know. Computer and digital camera. We need your help. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.